There is a growing body of research that shows African-American girls are punished in school at rates much higher than girls of any other race. It's part of the school-to-prison pipeline, which highlights how punitive school policies can lead to a host of negative outcomes. We wondered why punishment is being doled out at such high rates for these girls and how it's at play in our local schools. Contributor Jerry Mitchell recently spoke about this issue with two educators who were part of a conference at the University of Missouri-St. Louis. The conference centered on sharing solutions to help improve the experience of African-American girls in school.
Joining me in the studio today is Dr. Sheandra Brown. She is a Bachelor of Science from Grambling State University, 2 degrees in education, and a PhD in policy studies, also an instructional coach for the Hazelwood School District. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also, Christy Jackson, author of Girlfriends and God, a graduate of Fontbonne and Webster University, CEO of Social Synergy, is that correct?
Yes.
Founder of DK Annex, and also GLAM, which we will get into just a little bit later. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Today's discussion highlights the plight of African-American girls as it relates to education in society, more specifically the rate at which they are harshly disciplined, suspended, expelled, and even arrested in the school environment. In fact, according to the National Women's Law Center and NAACP report, Black girls received out-of-school suspensions at a rate of 16 to 1 for vague reasons such as disobedience and disruptive behavior as it relates to their white counterparts. And a symposium was recently held at UMSL on this topic called the Crooked Room Conference. Why this title and what does it refer to?
The purpose of the conference was really to get an understanding of the role that Black women play in various areas of academia. In education, for myself with the background in education, there are many times where there are stereotypes and people build perceptions about Black women. And so we have to walk in that crooked room where sometimes we go in as the sapphire, as the angry Black woman, and that's not the case, you know. And so we have to walk in those rooms where those stereotypes are built and stand upright and still be able to knock down those things that are said about us as Black women. So I think the purpose of that conference was to really celebrate the role that Black women play in various fields.
Yes, I agree. It was to identify that the room is crooked and that we are walking in those rooms upright, as you said. And the beauty of that conference is that it really looked at the female experience. Women of color are experienced holistically, culturally, education, business, education. It was just empowering to be in that space, to encourage one another, and to hear the interesting plights that we are in based on our different perspectives as women of color.
So crooked actually refers more metaphorically to society in general as it relates to women of color in the educational system and in society, period.
Absolutely.
Yes.
How has the dialogue, especially the dialogue around this crooked conference, if you will, or this crooked structure, if you will, affected change among students, parents, administration, and the community at large as it relates to African-American females?
You know, I think we always knew that the rooms are crooked and that we have are now being empowered to walk into those spaces and to hold people accountable. And not so much looking for how we can be helped, but garnering our resources together as a community and as women and taking our voices into those spaces. And again, holding people accountable for what is right. So I think a large part of that conference was empowering attendees with information. My session was around gifted education and identifying girls of color for gifted programs. And so a part of my presentation was really understanding that identification process and not just leaving it up to school districts to determine placement for students, but understanding the guidelines and the criteria and the flexibility that can be leveraged. So it's really about having information and knowing what you have access to. And I think that can be one of the challenges that we are beginning to see minimized as we talk more across lines and across disciplines, we're understanding mm-hmm. what we really have access to.
I absolutely agree with that. The role of the Crooked Room Conference, it was very, just very eye-opening and very enlightening. With the Crooked Room, a lot of times what I wanted to do with my research, because I talked about my research study, I looked at teaching at the top of the class, the role that Black female educators play in the classrooms, the action steps that they take, the tradition of bringing in some of the African traditions of other mothering, taking on that role of the African proverb that it takes a village to raise a child, and kind of highlighting those things and talking about how important relationship building is and counter storytelling, and allowing those teachers to have a voice in the role that they play in the lives of students. It was very empowering at the end, hearing the people that were in the audience, just listening to them and their concern about the role that we play as women in the field and giving them that voice. And again, as you said, Christy, just letting them know that there are resources out there and how they can step forward and take a role in their child's education and not just rely on the school to support them.
Right now we're talking about those children. You said that gifted children mm-hmm. and you're talking about teaching to the top.
Yes.
But we also have the opposite end of the spectrum.
Yes.
And the aforementioned report documents stereotypical descriptors of Black females as loud, mm-hmm. and confrontational, mm-hmm. and provocative. And given these labels, how does a young woman of color or a woman of color, period, develop strong positive traits and personalities while trying to remain on par with her white constituents or peers?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's about perspective. You mm-hmm. know, Dr. Donna Ford is really one of the yes. pinnacles mm-hmm. in being the voice of inclusion for gifted education. Mm-hmm. And so she often talks about these characteristics, that there are cultural maps for every other culture except for ours as women of color, people of color. And so, yes, we can be described as loud, or is it verbose? Yes. I mean, turn that thing around. We are who we are. And so it's really, in my opinion, reframing that perspective. Mm-hmm. And so it's not about changing who you are for anyone else. It's understanding the power that you have as a unique individual.
Mm-hmm. And also in this report, I did read something that said that according to this report, African-American girls are more likely to be held back and to score lower on standardized tests. But however, they still have a higher desire to be leaders, more so than their Hispanic or white counterparts.
And that deals with that resiliency yes. that they have. There is another researcher. Her name is, I believe it's Venus Howard. I believe it's Venus Howard. There is research out there where she did research where she was looking at gifted Black girls, and they have that resiliency where they will, as my research did, look at the role of other mothering. They connect with someone that reminds them of someone in their family or someone they want to emulate. And they have that ability to, no matter what the stereotype is, they are able to overcome those odds because it's just something within them. And it's that self-esteem of being able to be placed in an area that's difficult, where you're stacking the odds against me and I'm going to beat the odds. It's just something that's within those girls that allows them to keep pushing forward.
And generally their leaders or their go-tos
they
or their mentors
yes.
are the same
yes.
types of women, either
yes.
their mothers or their aunts,
mm-hmm. that's
or women
right.
who have had to be single parents.
Yes.
Or women
mm-hmm.
who have worked several jobs mm-hmm. in order to make it all happen for the family. And that is the person that they see
mm-hmm.
that is considered by society as aggressive,
yes.
as pushy, and that other word that we cannot say on the air
mm-hmm.
as it refers to women
Absolutely.
Who are overly aggressive
mm-hmm.
simply because you have to be heard. And sometimes when you have to push into the room, into that crooked space mm-hmm. to be heard and to be understood, you are often perceived as something other than assertive.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And of course, mm-hmm. when you say assertive and aggressive, we're referring generally to two different types of people as you visualize race.
Yes.
I want to go on to talk a little bit about the school-to-prison pipeline. It is mm-hmm. normally used to refer primarily to Black boys, but now Black girls are equally at risk. And I'd like to share the staggering scenario that's across the country. These are just some examples of what's happened in some schools, and I know you're with Hazelwood School District, and you may even hear something that relates to the school districts around us. In 2014, a 12-year-old girl faced expulsion and criminal charges after writing "Hi" on a locker room wall of her Georgia middle school. In 2013, an 8-year-old girl in Illinois was arrested for acting out a 16-year-old girl in Alabama who suffered from a myriad of illnesses, including sleep apnea, was hit with a book by her teacher and later arrested and hospitalized due to her injuries after she scuffled with law enforcement. We had another 12-year-old girl threatened with expulsion from an Orlando private school because she refused to change her natural hair. And then in 2007, a 6-year-old girl was arrested in a Florida classroom for having a tantrum. It goes on and on. Somebody refused to pick up cake off the floor, according to a school officer's satisfaction, and was arrested and put out of the school. So my question is, what's happening here and who's responsible?
Well, you know, the narrative is not any different historically. I think the settings are changing and the awareness is different. Now we have social media, yes. We have technology where we are able to document and respond to these situations. So I think, again, it just goes back to who gets to tell that story. Who gets to write the rules? And, you know, I'm kind of going back to your comment about, you know, changing our perspective about being loud. And, you know, it really depends on who gets to tell that story. Because, you know, when we're told to lean in and be bossy girls, mm-hmm. it's okay. Mm-hmm. Because someone else gets to tell that example, show that as the narrative, as the example. And so, you know, it is just interesting that we are in those positions where our power is given or taken, and we are not able to respond, you know, in the ways that we could historically based on the community support that we have, you know, the systematic racism that is in place, mm-hmm. the lack of inclusion that is in place. It really is dismantling power in particular areas. I was telling someone the other day, I remember, you know, growing up, whenever I would get in trouble at school, my pastor would come to school and he would talk to those principals and those teachers. And I might have been redirected, but not necessarily in the way that I could have been if I didn't have that support system. And so it just speaks to the power of having that community behind you.
Exactly.
And knowing that you have that village that is there to back you up and support you, because many families and areas don't have that.
Absolutely. And also, it's that lack of cultural awareness and coming into schools with those, again, with those stereotypes and creating those narratives about our girls that they're loud. And that's why relationship building is so important for us as Black educators and making sure that we connect with those children so that when we see them in the hallway and they're in trouble for something that's very small, that we can talk to those children a lot of times. Or a lot of times those children will simply ask, can I go see Dr. Brown? Or can I go see? Because they know that they can connect with us and we have a way of talking to them and getting them to calm themselves down and stopping those suspensions a lot of times from happening. So a lot of times we're able to intervene.
So would you say then there's a disconnect? Generally, when you walk into a school environment, and I'll speak specifically on a public school environment. We'll just talk about a public school for right now. Mm-hmm. For example, and the majority of the teachers are female, mm-hmm. as it is across the board, all throughout Teaching America. It's pretty much females teaching. And you have a lot of white females who are teaching. Mm-hmm. And how would you say that they can be helped to understand and to relate to the African-American female student who comes from a different background, who has examples that are aggressive, who are bold, who are running the household, so to speak, so they have to put their foot down. And they kind of mimic that behavior. How can we help those teachers in those positions, help those students and learn those students and learn those behaviors? Is it more of a behavioral or psychological classes that, you know, psychology classes that need to be taken so that an understanding can be had? What is necessary? Because a lot of times they come into a classroom and they're lost, and by no fault of their own, but they just have not been introduced to that culture.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that I put in my research at the end for possible future implications or for future research, is that I think that colleges of education and universities, they have to be able to do a better job of training teachers when they are going to go into schools that have large populations of Black children or minority children, because our children come to us with so much baggage. It's so different from when I started. This will be my 21st year in education. I know I don't look like it.
But do they confuse you in the hall?
But it's so different. And the kids come to us with so much emotional baggage. I mean, they are just totally scorned. Like they've been out in war, you know, and then they come to school and you don't have that understanding of how to support those children. One of the things that I will say that we've done in our district is that we have a program where they practice cultural competency. And so they allow days where we have early release or professional development to bring in people to talk to teachers and train them on how to work with children from backgrounds that are unlike their own. And that cuts down a lot of time on the teacher turnover rate because they have to understand the children. And again, in my research, looking at the role of other mothering, when I see teachers that are doing a wonderful job, they have great relationships, whether they're black or white, I always encourage the teachers, go to this teacher's classroom. Hey, look at what they're doing. Go and observe them and see how they're handling that to allow them to see a teacher modeling the types of behaviors, you know, that they should be exemplifying when they work with their students. And so that's just so key. You have to connect with the students regardless of your background, even though it may be different. You still have to build that relationship. And I think the cultural competence component is key.
And I think it's important, too, for the districts to make a commitment to the development of social justice training and embedding that as a part of the culture. The school district that I work in has made a commitment to allow every staff member, and not just teacher, but every staff member that wants to participate in social justice training to participate in that. And that has been an ongoing practice for the last 5 to 6 years within our district. And so, first of all, it's important to identify that you have a problem, that you need more information, and that you don't understand. Because I think a part of the problem is that there is a lack of willingness to identify that there is this gap of understanding. And so you see these disparities, and there's this lack of discomfort in information that is visible because the teacher is not necessarily as effective as they could be, but they're not willing to admit that this is a space that I can grow and that I can learn from. And so I think that creating that culture of learning, creating that safe space where educators can come and say, hey, this is an area that I really need some support in, and that that district is there to provide that space for them.
And that's one of the roles that I've done as an instructional coach in the building, is being able to establish a relationship with the teacher and so that they feel comfortable enough to say, hey, I'm having a problem with management in my classroom, or I'm having a difficult time connecting with this student, whether it's a female or a male, and being able to come to me and be comfortable enough to talk to me about it. And then we work on ways that we can help that teacher improve.
Now, I've got a good question for you. In-school suspension and out-of-school suspension. We've already kind of touched on out-of-school suspension. We know when they're out of the school, they're out of sight. They're generally no supervision. How does in-school suspension help a student, or does it?
You know, from my perspective, I believe that in-school suspension does help because, again, it still holds that student accountable for whatever that behavior is. And usually there are things that are missing, you know, when you still have assignments that have to get done. And so that is not being done necessarily when you are, you know, out of the building, because there are other things that they are maybe attending to at that time. So I believe in-school suspension still holds that student accountable and allows them to complete those assignments that may be required of them. But it also puts them in hopefully that positive environment. And we've all seen the example of the, you know, the suspension teacher and, you know, what that room could look like. But that could be such a powerful space to give that student a chance to breathe and to sort of reboot and be prepared to go back into that classroom. I've seen some practices now where students are doing yoga in those spaces and that they're doing more mindful activities during that time. And so that really does help prepare them to return back to that classroom and hopefully change some of those behaviors that got them there in the first place.
And what I've seen with in-school suspension is that sometimes the kids take it as somewhere to play. So it just depends on who's over the in-school suspension right. program. Because sometimes they'll do things so they can go in there. But again, and then they go back to the classroom and they do the same thing. And then you see them back in school suspension. And so we're not really, you know, rectifying the problem. You know, it's a repeated pattern. So sometimes it depends on who's in there and it needs to be some structure. But I do agree with you, Christy. One of the things that we're doing also in our district is introducing that mindfulness mm-hmm. and allowing those students to practice yoga and calming themselves down. We also have connected with Lutheran Services. And so we have someone in our building full time every day that the students can go and talk to as well. And they also connect with the families. And so that helps a lot also.
Does the school, specifically Hazelwood, does it connect with some of the organizations in the community, like
yes.
Sister to Sister and some of the organizations that actually help the young women specifically in the after-school programs and come inside the schools or do anything?
I know that they do connect with the Lutheran Services, so that reaches out to all families. I'm not sure what happens with the other buildings as far as them having programs that work directly with girls. That would be awesome if we could bring that to our building, since this is my first year there.
Okay.
In that building.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure, you know, how they've done it in the past, but I know last year for sure they had Lutheran Services that came in and worked with all of the families.
So once again, what I'm hearing you both say is that it's community-wide effort.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's a top-down in the school system. So we're talking from the superintendent all the mm-hmm. way down to the support staff
yes.
that actually help the students
yes.
throughout their day and
even
make
the
it throughout
custodians.
Their day.
Yes.
Absolutely
yes.
they do. The gym
yes.
teachers,
yes.
the lunch, the ladies
yes.
in the lunchroom actually
mm-hmm.
support. And so if we've got a full 360, we
yes.
can improve our attention, especially to our girls, because some people would argue that it's not always been this way. Something has changed in society.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we could spend probably another hour talking about mm-hmm. the social mores, the
yes.
poverty, the mm-hmm. sexual violence, all of the things that are pushed under the carpet as it relates to young African-American females, and the hunger and the peer pressure with
yes.
respect to attire and clothing and the haves and the have-nots.
Mm-hmm.
All of the pressures that go along with young women today are not the same as what we had in yesteryear, at least when I was in school, which was years ago. So real quick, let's talk really fast about zero tolerance school and how does this policy rule generally apply to students of color? Do they really apply to students of color? Do you see that more often than you do with white students? I read one article. I've got so much paper around me right now. So many articles I read. One about two students who got into a fight. Black girl, white girl. They were both sent to an alternative school. The white girl was back in school in 90 days, but the black girl had to sit out the entire year. So that was an imbalance there based on, and it could have had something to do with the girl's past record. Who knows? But as it relates to zero tolerance, does it help or is it a hindrance?
I think it has hindered our students greatly, that zero tolerance policy. You know, that, you know, one time that you mess up and that's it. You're out. We don't want to hear anything.
It's not life.
Right.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Not realistic.
I am really grateful that over the years there has been more research and programs that have looked into our students being suspended and our kids, you know, with the zero tolerance policy. They've looked at suspension. They've looked at the amount of students of color who are suspended. I think it has really been important that they've looked at those things, because now you have programs where you have additional services before we suspend the child.
Mm-hmm.
Let's try this. Let's call the parents in. Let's do interventions. So it has been very helpful that they're starting to kind of push zero tolerance out of the schools and look at other ways.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yes.
I'm mm-hmm. glad to hear that, because mm-hmm. it provides a hopelessness for students.
Absolutely.
That, you know they got one strike.
And
I mean, come on, in baseball, at least you get three. Right?
Right.
Christy,
that's
tell
right.
me about GLAM, your organization. What is
sure,
GLAM?
Sure. So GLAM stands for Girls Lead and Make Moves. And so we have really tried to be responsive to the statistics, the data, the experiences, our observations of young women in the community that we view them as powerful, but they can be misconstrued as those attributes that you talked about, being bossy, being loud, being, you know, too aggressive. And so we have created a space, a community where those young women are celebrated. And so through our programming, we give these young women spaces to develop the learning experiences that we create. And we connect them with mentors and opportunities to utilize those skills to help create a positive impact in the community.
How old is the organization?
Oh my gosh, we are just 2 years old, but we are growing by leaps and bounds.
Wonderful.
We have recently shifted to create this pipeline of support for young girls ages 11 to 18 with community-wide programming. But we also have our Train the Tribe format where we're mentoring young women ages 22 to 30 through mastermind groups and helping them to develop community-oriented programming. And then we have our leadership circle for more seasoned and experienced leaders so that we can create the next generation of leaders, founders, and funders for those organizations as well. So GLAM really has become a space of empowerment for women, young women, and more young at heart women, because we need each other.
What you're trying to say.
It has been really great to see it develop and thrive in the community.
Chrissy, how can you reach out to schools like Hazelwood Schools or Riverview or Ferguson Florissant or the St. Louis Public Schools? How can the community at large get involved?
So we do have a website. It's called glamgirls.com. And so you can find us online. We're on Facebook. We have a Facebook page, Instagram. But we are interested in having meetings with superintendents. I have some lined up very soon so that we can begin having conversations and customizing programs to meet the needs of your schools, because that's really one of the aspects that makes our organization different. We look at whatever problem you're trying to solve with your students, and we are willing to customize programming to meet those needs.
And how can we keep in touch with you, Doctor?
You can find me at Hazelwood School District, Sheandra Brown, S-Brown6 at hazelwoodschools.org.
I want to end with this, and this was about the Black Girl Push Out, and this was a quote from Monique W. Morris, the co-founder of the National Black Women's Justice Institute. Mm-hmm. We can no longer afford to leave young women and girls of color at the margins of our concerns with respect to the achievement gap, the dropout crisis, and the school-to-prison pipeline. Instead, we must develop gender and race-conscious prisms that capture the vulnerabilities that they experience today.
Yes.
And I want to thank you so much for joining me here on St. Louis Public Radio.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was contributor Jerry Mitchell. She recently spoke with Sheandra Brown and Christy Jackson about their involvement at a local conference addressing the experience of African-American girls in school. You can find more information about it and about the conference, which was held earlier this June. You'll find it online at stlpublicradio.org/STLonAir, where you should also check out our segment on hardships for African-American girls and our St. Louis History in Black and White page. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/STLonAir. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.